Chapter 47. Assault, battery, disorderly conduct, and insanity. The controlling interests in the affair now even try to bring a charge of insanity against Tom. In Hobart Payne's opinion, it was because he had vigorously opposed the operation of the radium dial plant. He considered that Tom had been persecuted. Tom's relatives thought such a move typical of a company with its back against the wall. "They know they're going to go down," said his niece Mary. "They'll do anything. They'll try anything." Fortunately for Tom, the police case against him was not reported to progress further than a handful of initial hearings, perhaps because there was no foundation to the trumped-up charges. Like all cowards with their backs against the wall, the company now chose to turn and run. In December 1936, Radium Dial abruptly closed its doors and upped sticks to where nobody knew. Nobody left behind did, at least. The Reeds followed the company out in the new year, packing up their house on Post Street. No longer would the Donahues and Purcells run into the girls' old boss when they made their way about town. Radium Dial had been run out of business by Joseph Kelly's new firm, Luminous Processes. After more than 14 years of the radium company operating in the old high school, the rooms fell silent. No chatter from the girls, no laughter from the dark room. Just empty rooms, haunted by the memories of all that had gone on. With Radium Dial gone, Joseph Kelly had a monopoly on radium dials in the little town of Ottawa. It may have been the Great Depression, but things were turning out rather well for the company president. The same, however, could not be said for the husbands of the former dial painters. They had just about managed to cling on to work through the Depression so far, but in 1937 their luck ran out. Workers were laid off from the Libby Owens glass factory, and Tom Donahue and Al Purcell were among them. For the Purcells, who had three children to feed, it became almost impossible to cope. "They struggled really hugely financially," said a relative. Charlotte ended up feeding the children mustard sandwiches. "You took whatever you could get," remembered Tom's niece Mary of that period. "It was a very tough time." Charlotte and her sisters agreed a solution: move to Chicago. But even in the city it was challenging. Charlotte's son Donald recalled, "We used to go to a bakery and ask for day-old bread. We heated the apartment with a coal stove, and we used to walk around the train tracks in Chicago and pick up coal." It was hard, but it was harder still back in rural Illinois. Pearl Payne said there was no steady work, just periodic streaks of work. Tom Donahue was not lucky enough to land even those streaks. With the house already mortgaged to the hilt, he was running out of ideas. "Tom was nearly bankrupt," remembered a brother-in-law. "Catherine was full of radium and dying by inches. She suffered agonies, and he spent everything buying medicines to try to relieve Catherine." The family now had debts of some $2,500. There was nothing else for it. "They were on relief for a while," confided their niece, Mary. "They felt very ashamed, not wanting people to know about it." Yet they weren't the only ones needing help. Lines of desperate people queued outside the soup kitchens in Ottawa. Everyone was living hand to mouth. The Donahues had almost no thought of a lawsuit anymore. This was a battle for survival. By the spring of 1937, their lawyer, Rosenthal, had dropped the case anyway. The women were due to have a hearing before the Illinois Industrial Commission later that year, but, as things stood, they had no attorney to represent them. End of CD 10.